The date is the 27th of July 1992, and this is the first recording in a series that is concerned with an oral history of Griffith University. The first interview is with the founding Chancellor of Griffith University, Sir Theodore Bray. Sir Theodore, how did you acquire your first knowledge of the proposal to establish Griffith University?
It came about from an inquiry I had made to state ministers when I retired from newspaper work in June 1970. I wanted something more to do than be a member of the Australia Council, so I had asked both federal and state ministers if they could give me just something to do of use to the community so that I wouldn't waste the latter part of my life. Towards the end of 1970, the Minister of Education, Mr. Alan Fletcher, telephoned me and said the Queensland government had decided, after 10 years of procrastination, to actively plan a second university, or at least a university college, to take the strain off the University of Queensland, which was greatly pressed in a number of areas of study. I told the minister that I knew nothing about universities except as the father of five graduates of the University of Queensland, and he might get somebody else. After about 2 weeks, he rang me and said, "If you won't do it, I'll give it to X." The man shall be known as X. He was a friend of mine. He was a leader in business and civic affairs in Brisbane. He was a staid conservative. I said to Mr. Fletcher, "I think I can do it better than X." He said, "So do I." And I said, "But I will only take on a job like this if I can nominate the people to work with me." He agreed to this, and after some discussion with him, and a particular discussion with friends of mine at the University of Queensland, we put together a planning committee which was announced as the Interim Council for Griffith University.
What year was that, Sir Theodore?
That was still that year, 1970, and on December 24, Christmas Eve of 1970, the Minister announced that a committee had been set up to... And this was the brief he gave me and announced publicly was the brief for the committee. It was to plan a second university institution for Brisbane. And that one-line brief was the instruction to the committee to set about planning a second university. And the minister never gave any more direction in the planning than that single sentence brief, although before we had the first meeting of the committee, I did ask him, I said, "Have you any idea what kind of university you want?" He said, "No, that's up to you to tell us."
So Theodore, you said the original reason was to take some of the stress from the University of Queensland in some areas because it was being overcrowded. Was that in your mind at all, or did that sort of vanish as the whole episode progressed?
Although we were told the areas in which Queensland or University of Queensland was pressed, we took no notice of that, because when the committee met, we decided to take a totally fresh approach to setting up a university. The committee you've got a record of it, and...
Well, could we just mention some of the people now that...
We'll mention them all, if you like, Miss
I think that might
Thoms,
be a good idea.
Because...
It gets it on the record on
it's
the
It's an interesting record of the people who were chosen, and I want to emphasise that it was my choice, governed by some limitations imposed by the University of Queensland making people available. Mm-hmm. Now, this is the committee that which was announced and met in January in 1971, nearly a month after the announcement, because it had not been possible because of Christmas holidays to get the committee together before the end of January. And this was the committee, and I'll read them and how they were designated at the time of appointment. T.C. Bray, Director, Queensland Newspapers, Chairman of the committee. L.W. Butts, Solicitor, Vice Chairman of the committee. Mrs. G.M. Butts Olson, known as Molly, Principal of the Women's College, the University of Queensland. N.M. Gow, Chamber of Commerce Chairman. Arthur Petfield, later Sir Arthur Petfield, Chairman, Chamber of Manufacturers, or Manufacturers. I must correct myself, manufacturers. S. Schubert, Chief Engineer, Department of Coordinator General of Public Works. J. A. Sewell, Auditor General for Queensland. W. Wood, Chairman, Board of Advanced Education. They were the laypersons on the committee, as against academic. Five academics were on the committee. That was one condition the minister imposed on me, that I should have five academics in a planning committee of, I think, 13. Mm-hmm. But all the academics were known to me and had been selected after discussion with the acting vice-chancellor of the University of Queensland, Professor Teakle.
Right.
The five academics on the committee were Professor W.J. Campbell, Education, Professor S. Lipton, Statistics, Professor C. F. Presley, Philosophy, Professor G. E. Roberts, Architecture, all of those from the University of Queensland, and Professor P. Mason, a physicist from Macquarie University, Sydney, who had been recommended by the Department of Education. And I want to make this point, that Mason was brilliant, an innovative thinker who thought up schemes for schools and promoted ideas for integrated teaching and research. The lay people selected, as you could realise from the names, were representing law, manufacturing, business, and a bright young civil servant, as Sid, later Sir Sidney Schubert, was then regarded. I tried in the early days to get a representative of either the Trades Hall or the Labour Party. I did not want on the committee, and declined suggestions from some members of the committee that we should plan a, or have on a, what we were proposing finally as a preliminary governing body of the university, members of parliament representing either the government or the opposition, such as they have in the University of Queensland Senate. I didn't want that, but I did want a representative of that great body of people who vote for the Labour Party or the Non-Conservative Party, and I suggested that to the Minister that we should ask Jack Edgerton, who was then the Secretary, and I think also the President of the Trades Hall in Brisbane, to come on the committee. The Minister said that He was not opposed to the idea, but his colleagues were. Well, I persisted with that request for 6 months and finally persuaded the Premier, Mr. Jockey Peterson, later Sir Joe, to accept the idea that Edgerton would be a useful member of the committee, and Edgerton was finally co-opted onto the planning committee and was a useful member for a limited time. But that's the only time I think I won an argument with Mr. Joe Jockey Peterson.
Was the Southside location an important factor?
Not really. The Southside location happened to be available because 10 years before, the University of Queensland had thought of establishing a university college in the way that James Cook was set up as a university college at Townsville originally. They had thought of setting up another college on the south side of Brisbane. And the government had acquired, and I think it acquired the site from the City Council. That I am not sure, but I'm sure if you look up the deed, the title deeds, which should be in your library, you will find that the University of Queensland acquired this site in about 1965. And in later years, several years before 1970, actually had part of the ring road built. And this site, 400 acres, part of Toohey Forest, was available. Now, the minister did not say we should use this site. He said it's available and we would like you to think about using it. Well, the planning committee, when it began to function, looked at this site and was greatly taken with the unspoilt bushland. But we also did consider another site, the Roma Street Railway Yards, because when we got our Vice-Chancellor, which is yet to be recorded, he was much taken with the idea of putting up a high-rise building in the heart of the city and attracting students from the surrounding area into the heart of the city. But the planning committee had settled the site before the Vice-Chancellor actually took office. So the site was suggested to us, and, the more we looked at it, the more we decided it would be a good idea to use this magnificent natural bush and to set up a university on the south bank and to try to bring some facilities which the south of Brisbane had lacked up to that point in time.
Were there to be any specific moves towards certain courses, and were there any courses which had been prohibited? I mean, courses that you were not going to...
No, well, when the committee met, as it did, we set about looking at what types of universities had been established in recent years, or indeed had been established in the English-speaking world since World War II. And immediately after the first meeting, in January 22, 1971, Mr. Topley, who had been made available to me as chairman of the committee as a secretary, he had been personal assistant to Zelman Cowan, later Sir Zelman, at the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Queensland, and Topley, from the time the announcement was made, had fed me over the holiday period an almost library of books on new universities set up in the United Kingdom, in Australia, and in the United States of America. And immediately after the first meeting of council, Topley and I set out on a voyage of discovery. We went to see Professor Carmel in Adelaide. He was then Vice-Chancellor of Flinders University, And Carmel, of course, had at that time set up two universities from the time he was Professor of Economics at the Adelaide University. He had set up Flinders in Adelaide and he had set up Papua New Guinea in Moresby. So he was the most experienced man in setting up new universities. Mm. And we went to see Carmel and spent some days with him. We went to Melbourne and we saw the Chancellor of Monash, which had been set up in a great hurry. We went to La Trobe, which had set up a university with studies organised in schools rather than faculties. We went to Macquarie in Sydney, which had been set up with schools rather than faculties. And we came back and we recommended, Topley and I, we recommended that in light of the Australian experience and in light of what had happened, particularly with what are called the red brick universities in the United Kingdom, that we should aim in our new university, whatever it was to be called, and by this time it was known it would be Griffith, because that was one decision the Cabinet made before we met, that they would like us to use the name Griffith to honour Sir Samuel Griffith. So that when we came back to plan studies for Griffith, we came back with the idea that it would be good for Griffith to aim at organising its studies in schools rather than in faculties and departments, because we were convinced by Carmel and by the experience in Macquarie and La Trobe that it was a scheme of study which was quite useful, and what we thought would meet the times, because we knew we were planning a university for the last 20 years of the 20th century and for the working into the 21st century. And I would like to put on record a thing that was always in my mind in planning studies, and it was that the main activity of a university can be put in this way. Liberal cultivation of the mind for those capable of it. And I think Topley and I kept that in our minds in our visits to the other new Australian universities. And we came back and there was very soon complete agreement that the first thing the Griffith Interim Council, the planning body, should do would be decide what not to teach, mm-hmm. before we decided what to teach. Mm-hmm. So we cleared the ground. We were not going to even consider the professional schools like medicine, engineering or law, because we thought they were strong enough at the University of Queensland. But we would set out to organise studies based on community problems and the needs of, as far as a human being can determine what the needs of a community are going to be in 5, 10, 15, 20 years. That's beyond the mind of man, but you can speculate on what you think the community will expect in the training of the best young minds who are normally attracted to universities. So we came back saying, well, now, can we organise studies in areas which will take notice of the needs and the problems of the community, not now particularly, but towards the end of this century? And, for instance, in the, when we started, of course, obviously the community would expect to have, if we were going to have schools, and we easily came to agreement that we would have schools because they were working in Flinders and they were working in La Trobe. They haven't worked as well since. They were working at Macquarie and the students liked them, the staff liked them, the community accepted them. And we thought that we could build schools around some certain needs of the community. And for instance, in the School of Humanities, whether they remember it or not, was based on the idea that the School of Humanities would consider values in the community and how those values could be transmitted or communicated. Now, whether the School of Humanities ever remembers that, I don't know, but that was the original intention of the School of Humanities. And the School of Science, of course, was to be based on what probably we thought might be looking out. Could we get working? One thing we were very keen on was could we get, and this was where Professor Mason was a great inspiration to us, could we get integrated teaching in science, and could we get integrated research in science? Could we get physicists and chemists working together? Because in the old and traditional universities, physicists and chemists often didn't even talk to one another, let alone consider joint lectures or joint integrated research. But Mason had this, he was a tremendous man for a cause. And of course Mason died early and was a great loss to Australian science, but he believed we could get scientists working together to solve some of the community's problems and contribute to the advance of knowledge. And then we thought that the community would expect us to have a School of Humanities and a School of Science. But then, for the rest of what we were going to plan, we hit upon the idea of a School of Asian Studies. And for this, I unashamedly take credit. That was my idea, and I said, if we do nothing else in this university, we will teach Asian studies and we will cultivate good relations between Asia and its neighbours around the Pacific Rim. And that idea was accepted because there was a consciousness, and you will recall from your association with newspapers, Miss Thomas, the Deputy Chancellor now of Griffith, that in the Kuriyamale we were pushing the idea that Australia was part of Asia, geographically at least, if not spiritually, and that Australians must wake up to the fact, to use a vulgarism, must wake up to the fact that we had to get on better with our neighbours and learn to live with them and trade with them and exchange cultural activities with our Asian neighbours.
So Theodore, you may remember that the Kuriyamale was the first newspaper in Australia to run a series of 12 lessons in simple Malay.
Yes, it was organised by a lady called Patience Toms. I well remember it. So now that we've got ourselves a bit of credit each, we'll pursue the oral history of Griffith. Thank you, Miss Toms, for reminding me of that. But the idea was accepted that Asian studies we would tackle. And then there was a faint glimmer in the mind of the public, if the public has a mind, that there should be more interest in the environment. Very faint stirrings of interest in the environment. And I would think a number of members of the planning committee would take credit for pushing that. I know Mrs. Boots Olsen did, and I think even Sid Schubert did. And certainly Professor Mason did. Professor Presley would have. Professor Presley was a philosopher who was deeply interested in the moral values of a community, which to his mind did include looking, nurturing our environment. And Presley was a good philosopher and a very strong man in the planning of Griffith University. So we hit upon these four schools. And then we, once we'd, planned the four schools, and a vague idea of what we were going to teach, then we had to find somebody to do it. And of course, the first concern of the planning committee obviously had been to find some funds, because the government had made no indication of how it would fund us. Remember, at that time, universities were jointly funded by state governments and the Commonwealth government. Mm-hmm. And on our famous pilgrimage, or voyage of discovery, Topley and I had called in Canberra to see Sir Henry Baston, who was the then chairman of the Universities Commission, and had negotiated with him some we hoped some federal support for this new university. And because I'd got Mr. Sewell, Alan Sewell, onto the planning committee, we had direct access to the treasurer of Queensland, Gordon Chalk, later Sir Gordon. And Sir Alan negotiated with Chalk for some funds to be diverted to Griffith University in the planning stages, because we obviously had to have some money. We'd been given a bit of housing room at, first of all, at the University of Queensland, where Zelman Cowan made a room available to us. Topley and I set up an office there. And then I'll let the physical side of it for a minute, and then I'll stay on this for a while, mm-hmm. and then come back to the academic planning, but just to get the physical stage set, that we did have for a month or two. We had two or three months at the University of Queensland, and in that time, in the very early days, Zelman Cowan was most helpful, and he helped us arrange one very significant conference in which we got distinguished people from a number of other universities, including Jack Crawford, Sir John Crawford, up to advise us. And Sir John, of course, in his time, was both the Vice-Chancellor of ANU and the Chancellor of ANU, and is, I am certain, the wisest man I have ever met.
Wonderful man.
He came up and took part with a number of other distinguished academics and university administrators at a conference in the University of Queensland, which we discussed, you know, what we should teach and how we should teach while we were still at the University of Queensland. And then we moved our office into the city, into what the executive building in George Street, because Charles Barton, later Sir Charles, who was Coordinator General and with whom I was friendly, had spare space in his new department and quite obviously wanted to protect his space from other departments, so he offered us rent-free space in the Coordinator General's department, which saved us from falling into the hands of the Education Department. Now, Mr. Wood, who was the Education Department's nominee on the Planning Committee, had an office out in Auchenflower, quite near the Wesley Hospital. Mm. He offered us space, but fortunately I'd made a deal with Barton before Wood's deal could be taken to any responsible body, so that the fact that we could get free space in the executive office with access to ministers was quite important, and to my mind quite important to save us from falling under the physical domination of the Department of Education of the state, which I wished to avoid.
Who was in the office at that time? You and John Topley?
We moved in there on our own, and then from there we recruited other people. But we moved
in. There were clerical assistants as well.
Well, and not until we got there.
No. Yeah. But you recruited clerical
assistants there, yes. Shall I continue on the physical side?
Yes.
We stayed there until we outgrew the space that Charlie Barton could give us. And then we found a space in Toowong, in Sherwood Road, I think it is, in Toowong. Before we were 6 months old, we were out there, and it was at a luncheon in this, I think we were celebrating, probably moving into this office, and we had among our guests for luncheon the Premier, and it was at that luncheon I finally persuaded the Premier to accept Jack Edgerton. So I remember those rooms at Toowong, and from there we moved to Evans Road, Salisbury, into an older warehouse, and by that time we were starting to set up a library. We had a library in a shed in the same area in Salisbury.
And were you buying the books, or were they given to you?
Oh, we had some given to us, and I think by that time we were probably buying books. And then we stayed in Salisbury and Evans Road until we could move onto this site here to Nathan. So that's the physical side of the early days.
What was the sort of accommodation that you had on site at Nathan when you first came out to
it? Oh, well, when we didn't come
to... There were no buildings, of course.
Oh, and we didn't come to Nathan until the first buildings
were...
We were almost ready to take students, because I shall go back now, if I may, to the beginnings of the planning of the teaching and learning. Mm-hmm. People forget that learning is also one of the aims of a university, as well as teaching.
Yes, indeed.
But we had that very much in our mind, that we were going to organise teaching and learning. And we... first decision, actually, that the planning committee took in its first meeting was to open for teaching in 4 years.
That was in 19...
That was in January 1971, so we aimed to open the university for teaching in 1975. We did it, but this decision, I must put on record, was opposed violently by the representative of the Department of Education.
Why?
Because he thought it was not possible. And by one of the professors from the University of Queensland, who thought it was an idiotic decision. But they were overruled by the rest of the committee. And we pushed ahead with the 4 years, which had been recommended by... me and by Topley in our voyage of discovery, because we'd said to Professor Carmel, how soon can you open a new university? He said, if you want to do it thoroughly, you need 4 years. You can't do it properly in less than 4 years. He said, Monash did it in less than 4 years and made a number of mistakes, but they were forced by the Victorian government to open early because of the pressures on, particularly with training engineering students, and Monash was primarily a university based on engineering. But he said, if you want to do it properly, you need 4 years, you can do it in 4 years. So we said, we will do it in 4 years, and that was the first decision we actually made into the minutes. I've got the minutes of the first meeting, and they show that that was the first decision by the planning committee, was to open in 4 years, and we worked towards that. And when the minister heard that, he had come to the first meeting, but after he'd addressed us, he left us to our own decisions. And when I reported it to him, he said, well, go to it. And we did. But then the only other advice he gave me, and this was the last advice he gave me, he said, get yourself a good vice chancellor and your problems are over. Well, I said, I don't think it's as simple as that, Mr. Minister, but we'll take your advice and as soon as we can get a good vice chancellor. And as we proceeded with the academic planning and the committee, none of whom was paid, you've got to know that, these were all people with other jobs who gave their talents and their time to the planning of this university without any reward except the satisfaction of setting up a new university. We met, all of us, at least once a month and sometimes two or three times a month. And the meetings were sometimes quite exciting, because I had come from an area of decision-making in newspapers, nine months before, in which you make up your mind every day and every hour of the day to do something, whereas academics are inclined to have a meeting and decide to meet again. With all respect to them, they were not geared to instant decision-making. And constantly the meetings ended with the chairman saying, for God's sake, make up your mind. We can't wait another fortnight or another month. And we did make up our mind to proceed. And, of course, we had to set about finding a vice-chancellor. And many months were up, we were advertising worldwide.
May I just ask a question? At this stage, did the committee have separate little subcommittees?
Oh, yes, we had about six committees. One was to be an academic committee, there was to be a finance committee, there was to be an administration committee. We had the areas of specialised planning. And I had the good fortune, by virtue of my position as chairman, to sit on every committee, which I did, because I thoroughly enjoyed it. So there were at least six committees functioning separately, as well as the main planning committee, which came together
which
at least once a
for
month,
you.
Which a lot of meetings for everybody. And we took into account in our planning the opinions of students. Now, not many people realise that students took part in the planning of Griffith University, because we had it firmly in our minds that students should be consulted at all stages in university planning and university administration. And having no students, we borrowed students. And by arrangement with the university union, or student union, the University of Queensland, they nominated two students, or a panel of students, from which we drew two students. And we did have, I think, two students for a full year, and then they might have changed. But students come and go. Mm-hmm. The university goes on, but students come and go. And at all times, we had at least two students co-opted to meet with the planning committee, two senior students from the, not graduate students, no, but undergraduate students, to meet with the planning committee.
Did that work well?
Yes, they were quite useful. Mm. Sometimes they were a damn nuisance, as students always are on planning committees, but they were useful. And I got to the point we were advertising for a vice-chancellor. Oh. Well, we did advertise for a vice-chancellor, but we realised that about June of the year, we had no authority. Well, we knew we had no authority because there was no act. We were simply a committee appointed by a minister of the Crown, but that didn't give us much standing of any kind. So to function as a university planning committee, or as the beginnings of a university, we needed an act to give us authority, and an act under which we could appoint officers of the university. And the first officer we had to appoint, of course, was the vice-chancellor.
Did the committee discover this and decide this, or was it...
Oh, we knew this from the early stages, because Mr. Butts, the vice-chairman, was a legal identity, a senior partner, a retired senior partner of the leading law firm in Queensland at the time. And his main task, and he headed a legal subcommittee of the planning committee, their task was to draft an act, an act to set up Griffith University as a legal entity, and with powers to hire staff and to let contracts for buildings. Well, Mr. Butts scoured all the acts setting up all the universities in Australia. He drafted a bill which was submitted to the state parliamentary draftsman, a bill for an act to establish Griffith University. And the parliamentary draftsman suggested only one change in that draft bill.
Isn't that marvellous?
And that change was at the direction of the ministers, who objected to Griffith proposing to have four student representatives on the governing body of the university when it was set up. They were rather shocked at the idea of taking students into our council in the planning, and they were even more startled by the fact that in a governing body of 24, we proposed to have four students.
Was that two undergraduates and... No, you couldn't have postgraduate
students. We didn't have any. We wanted four students.
Yes.
And the minister suggested that the student representation should be cut down to three. And we agreed to that. But then we found a problem when this draft bill had been agreed on with the one change, a great tribute to Mr. Butt's skill as a draftsman. We found that there was a problem that Parliament next meeting would be the budget session, and which is normally not permitted to deal with any legislation. So we said to the minister, well, unless you make an exception to your parliamentary rules and deal with the Griffith Act, we will have no power to appoint a vice-chancellor or to let tenders for any buildings. We'll have no legal authority of any kind. So you'll have to break your rule. And after consultation with his cabinet colleagues, they did. And the Griffith Act was passed, I think, it would have been nearly August by that time. And we were hoping to get a vice-chancellor. It would have been one of our aims to get a vice-chancellor by the end of the year. We'd already advertised with having no authority, legal authority.
This was still 1971.
Oh, yes, still 1971. But we had aimed to get a vice-chancellor and a planner, a site planner, in position by the end of the year. They were early decisions we made. But we had no authority to engage anybody. But the Act was finally, the Griffith University Act was passed. It must have been in August in the budget session. Mm-hmm. And then we had the authority. By that time we'd been advertising. So then it was then tremendous urgency to find the suitable candidates for the office of vice-chancellor and site planner. Well, we got applications from the United States of America, we got applications from the United Kingdom, we got from South Africa, and I personally telephoned a number of Australians, academics working in the United States and in the United Kingdom, to inquire if they were interested in applying for the post. One or two were, and one was actually brought back to Australia to be interviewed. Now, for obvious reasons, I won't name these gentlemen, but in the end, from a very strong field, we offered the post, and I think this should go on record, we offered the post to an Australian professor of science. I won't name which science, because that would easily identify him. Mm-hmm. He accepted the offer, but before his acceptance, the offer could be reported to the next formal meeting of the planning committee, he withdrew his acceptance. And the selection committee found itself within two days of the meeting in which we hoped to announce the appointment of vice chancellor, with nobody in sight. So the selection committee met on the day of the meeting of the planning committee, and decided at 5 o'clock in the afternoon to offer the post to Professor Willett, who was then running the School of Business Administration at the University of Melbourne, had planned a School of Business Administration at Cambridge, was an MBA of Harvard, and was a very distinguished scholar. And at 6 o'clock that evening, I rang Willett and offered it to him. I said, will you accept this post if we offer it to you? He shouted yes into the telephone, greatly to my relief. And an hour later, I reported to the planning committee that Professor Willett would accept the post if we offered it to him. We did, and he did. And we got a good vice-chancellor, as recommended by the Minister of Education. And we were very happy to persuade Professor Willett to come and join our planning before the year expired. He came and worked with us before November, And I personally appealed to the Chancellor of Melbourne University, who was then Sir Robert Menzies, the ex-Prime Minister, retired Prime Minister, and he agreed to release Professor Willett so that he could join us in 1972. And at the same time, we were able to get a planner, Roger Johnson, from Canberra, who had been recommended to us by a man who'd come up to look at the site during the year, a man from Adelaide, Mr. Harrison, G.J. Harrison, who was a planner of Flinders University. He was engaged to do the initial planning of the site, which of course was 177 hectares of untouched bush. And it was on Mr. Harrison's advice that the Griffith Interim Council engaged Roger Johnson to prepare a master plan for the site. And this master plan, as you know, involved retention of all the trees on the site and the limitation of buildings to the height of the trees. And of course Griffith has improved the site with the cultivation of all native trees and shrubs. And as a result, I think of the wisdom of the planners, we have by far the most attractive campus in the whole of the continent of Australia.
Mm. I'd agree there. One of the things that they did do too was to, for the first time, to be able to transplant the Xantharia or grass tree. This was discovered by...
By Colin Phillips, whatever you call him now, he's a genius with plants. I know he sees UFOs and he's got some very determined ideas and number of fields, but Colin is a genius handling plants, and I think Griffith should always pay great tribute to him for developing this native site and filling it as full as it can be of trees and shrubs. It's got a lot more trees and shrubs on it now than it had when we took it over.
Really?
And you can't, unless you're flying over the site now, you wouldn't know it was filled with buildings and thousands of students and staff.
Yeah.
I've got to admit there is staff.
Drive around the ring road
and you wouldn't know.
Buildings
and it's a stroke of genius to preserve this site and improve it in the way it's been improved.
Sir Theodore, was there any early indication of a special ethos to be encouraged? Now, you said that you were looking at the needs, the problems of the community, so that touches on our problem-solving ideas, and you also said that you wanted to have, what the modern idea is, interfacing between different disciplines. And that is our interdisciplinary idea. Did this all evolve from those original decisions, or were there any other special areas of the ethos of Griffith?
You're using a Greek word, Miss Toms, I think, which was never in our mind. We were Anglo-Saxons with lacking classical training. Except maybe Professor Presley. But we did have the idea that we hope we could sense what the community would want us to teach our students, which would make them useful citizens and could cope with the problems that the community would face. We did in the early stages issue an invitation to the public, to anybody, to write to us, to give us ideas on what we thought we should consider in planning our teaching and learning and our research when we came to research. But we got very limited response because although, like Mr. Gower appealed to the Chamber of Commerce and Mr. Petfield appealed to the Chamber of Manufactures and Mr. Edgerton appealed to the Trades Hall, we didn't get much substantial help from the public. They left it to us to devise how we should organise study.
There was from the beginning a feeling that university education should not be denied to anybody who was able to, as you say, to
benefit
by it.
That was it.
and that there should be, well, at the beginnings was said there should be no prerequisites with regard to qualifications.
Well, we went further than that. We set out originally in our planning to, in setting up the four schools, we said we would hope we'd get about 100 students in each school originally. But in all the planning, we said we would take what we called mature students. And we didn't, as mature students have come to be regarded, probably people up to age of 25 or something, we had the idea that everybody should have access to the university if they wanted it. And it was quite likely that people in their 40s and 50s, or even older, should be given a chance. So we made it a rule in the early days that 10% of the student intake should be mature, what we called mature students. We were not concerned if they had any formal education. In fact, in the early years, all the applicants for mature students were interviewed and decided by interview whether or not they should be given a place as a mature student. So in the early years, we kept very, very firmly to the idea that 10% of the student intake would be people who had lacked the chance to qualify in the accepted way of coming through secondary education and getting some sort of a standard of learning into them. I don't say learning, some sort of
achievements.
They'd got some level, had gone through some level of teaching. Mm-hmm. But we had people who came to us into the mature student area who'd no formal education at all. And those students we found in the early days were the most highly motivated students. They were desperate to get into university and they just couldn't believe their good fortune that they were admitted to university, and they just showed how hard students can work.
Original planning for the students who came to us at that time, well, before the students came to us, at that time there were university fees. When the planning began, 1971, university fees were charged throughout Australia. And it was not until the Whitlam area.
1974. For student fees were abolished.
Were abolished, yes.
So they were abolished before we began students. But in the meantime, there'd also been a complete change in the financing of universities, because in the end December 1974 election, December 1972.
Mm.
Yes. Whitlam won power,
yes,
and came into power with a policy of free education, of abolishing charges for university education. And by 1974, the arrangements had been changed completely. The Commonwealth Government took over completely the funding of all Australian universities and had abolished fees. Mm. So although we started planning when fees were still being charged, we opened up in a time a year after fees had been abolished. Mm-hmm. More than a year after. Oh, fees must have been abolished in 1973, I think, by Whitlam swept the board clean in 1973 and swept a lot of things away which were not be spoken about.
Were there any disagreements at the meetings of the interim council?
Yes, a number. Of course, there were.
I've heard that there were, very strong arguments and
That was the nature of the meetings.
Yes.
There were some very fiery exchanges, particularly with some of the more conservative members of the council and one or two, very advanced thinkers in the council, like Professor Mason, And, well, there were exchanges between the town and Gowan representatives, because Gowan often moves slowly and town moves quickly. But we reconciled our differences often by, after a fiery meeting, going to dinner in a Chinese restaurant and settling our differences over a good meal.
Did you have a consensus result?
Never had any voting.
You didn't have any voting?
Never had any voting that I can recall.
No, so it was a consensus.
We hammered the heads of those who disagreed with us.
See? The significant appointments, well, Professor Willett, of course, what influence did Professor Willett have, in your view, on the establishment of the academic side of the university?
Oh, he was the mastermind. Yeah. You'd better say that. And pay great tribute to Professor Willett. He's an astonishing man. He came up here with incredible enthusiasm and energy. And he was established here early in 1972, and he was quite appalled by some things he found, because, for instance, in the School of Environmental Studies, everybody thought it was a good idea, but nobody had the faintest idea how to establish it as an acceptable area of tertiary study. And Willett had to thrash that out with early staff, but he himself must have put most of the early ideas into the planning of the School of Environmental Studies, because, okay, Presley knew what he thought should go into humanities, the sciences, well, Mason knew what he thought should go into the School of Sciences. I had a fairly good idea, although I'm not a university man of any kind. I had a fair idea what we should try to do in Asian studies. And Willett had to really flesh out the School of Environmental Studies, which was just a grand idea. It was a good idea, but we hadn't given much thought of how on earth we'd organise environmental studies at a tertiary level and make it acceptable and then have any integrity or depth in it. But He gave it real meaning, as he gave the whole university real meaning. A tireless worker, and he and his wife Jean, of course, in the selection of staff, which we got busy on in 1972, and I think by the end of 1972 we had almost 80 academic staff appointed by the end of the second year, including the chairman of the schools. But in that process, we had a wonderful time, really a wonderful time, advertising around the world. We got 800 applications for the key posts in the four schools. You see,
800?
Yes. We advertised worldwide again, and what we were looking for was a chairman and a second professor, because one of the things in our mind from the early planning been dinned into me by Professor Carmel, a very great man, who by this time had become chairman of the Australian Universities Commission in Canberra. He said, don't have a god professor, one man who's head of a school or a department or a faculty. Have several professors and don't let anyone be god, because that's fatal in a university. So we set out to get two professors, a chairman and a deputy chairman, for each of the four schools. As I say, we advertised worldwide, and we brought people in from the States. I telephoned so many professors that I've forgotten how many telephone calls we made all around the world, chasing people, and we brought them from all over Australia, and everybody who was brought to Brisbane as an applicant for a chair in any of the four schools was entertained at a dinner by Professor and Mrs. Willett in the house they had over in Kenmore. And Jean Willett was a notable cook, and we had some celebrated feasts choosing or interviewing the applicants for the professorship, and we got a a team of which I am proud, and I think of which Griffith is proud, the first 8 professors. And
School of Modern Asian Studies, could you tell me the people that were first appointed in the School of Modern Asian Studies?
Yes, it's a typical university story. Among the applicants for the position of chairman was Mr. Stephen Fitzgerald, professor. No, he wasn't. Dr. Stephen Fitzgerald. I think he was at ANU at the time. And remember, we're in Asian studies, and we must make this clear from the beginning, this was a completely new field for undergraduate studies. There were Asian studies at a postgraduate level at ANU and possibly one other university, but no other university in Australia had set out to have Asian studies at the undergraduate level. And we did, and we attracted a very strong field of applicants for the position of chairman. And outstanding was Dr. Stephen Fitzgerald, who told us when we interviewed him that if the Labor Party won the election, this was in December 1972, he would be offered by Mr. Whitlam, who would be Prime Minister, Fitzgerald would be offered the post of first ambassador to the Republic of China. And he said that if Whitlam won the election, he would withdraw. Well, Whitlam won the election, Fitzgerald was not considered, and Professor Ho Ping Yeok was appointed chairman. He came to us with exactly the qualifications I felt we needed for the position of chairman of the School of... We called it Modern Asian Studies, and you might want to know why we made that distinction, because it's not an academic term, and it's a term which was scorned by a number of learned gentlemen in other universities. But it was done deliberately to give the impression that we wished our staff and students to be concerned with immediate relations with our Asian neighbours, and not concerned with teaching, for instance, Chinese poetry, or, you know, medieval philosophers, or even the early science in China. But we wanted our students in Asian studies to have some contact with the language and customs and culture of our current Asian neighbours. We're interested in modern Asia, not in medieval or historic or ancient Asia, and that was to be the emphasis in our studies in the school. And we were looking for somebody who could direct the teaching of languages as a tool of communication with our neighbours. Somebody would be acquainted with what we regarded to be the 3 key languages we should teach in the school, and that was to be Chinese, Mandarin, of course, it was to be Japanese, and to be basic Malay for Indonesia and Malaysia. And we found in Professor Ho Ping Yeok, who was then at Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia, a man who could teach at tertiary level in those 3 languages, and a man who was a world authority on some aspects of Chinese history.
Astronomy too, wasn't it?
Yes, well, actually, he had already written for a volume. There is a definitive history of science, which has in it a special volume on the significance of the discovery of gunpowder.
Oh, yes.
And Professor Ho Ping Yeok had already written this volume for a Cambridge colleague. And Professor Ho had grown up in Singapore, the son of a Chinese warlord who had fled who had fled China and settled in Singapore, so his native tongue was Chinese. And not only does, you know, Mandarin, but Cantonese, the dialect of Shanghai. He had lived under the Japanese occupation, become fluent in Japanese, and could write and teach in Japanese, and lecture, as he proved he can, in Japanese, and had moved to, because he was Chinese, out of Singapore into, well, not because he was Chinese, because he was Chinese, into Malaysia, but then was unhappy in Malaysia because he was Chinese. But by being a professor in Kuala Lumpur, he obviously was competent at the tertiary level in basic Malay. So that was the man we found for to be chairman of the School of Asian Studies. And of course, he was appointed, and he accepted it when Fitzgerald withdrew. And the other initial professor, of course, was Professor Colin McCarris, who at the time was teaching in Beijing with his wife Alice. They were both teaching in Beijing, and accepted, and that was another first class. Of all the original appointments were good. You want to put on record the others?
Yes, I think it would be a good.
Well, let's see if I can remember them. Of course, Professor Presley.
This is in the other schools?
Yes, School of Humanities.
Yes.
Professor Presley, of course, was on the planning committee, and he obviously was the man who would head the School of Humanities. Do you remember who came with him? No, I'm trying to...
Yeah.
I should... Here we are. Let's deal with the chairman, the other chairman. They're the important people. Well, School of Humanities, Professor Presley. He was the first appointment to faculty staff because he was virtually self-appointed, being on the planning committee and the obvious man to chair the School of Humanities. Yes. He brought with him from University of Queensland, Andrew Field.
Oh, yes.
So Andrew Field must have been called a professor. Because he Presley and Field were the first staff. Of course, Field has left Griffith after working in American universities and is now an essayist for the Daily Press.
Yes.
The chairman of the School of Science, Professor R.D. Guthrie, known as Gus Guthrie, who was an Englishman, had been a reader in chemistry in the University of Sussex. And, of course, just to complete, Gus Guthrie came and was a distinguished chairman, and he left us to go back to London to be secretary of the Royal Chemical Society in London. And while there, he married a Griffith graduate after divorce from his first wife. And they both returned to Australia in recent years. And he is now, of course, Vice Chancellor of the University of Technology in Sydney, a man with an enormous institution of 6 campuses. You might think you've got 4 campuses here, but he has 6 campuses around Sydney and has done very well, Professor Guthrie. Now, the School of Environmental Studies was headed, the chairman, Professor Calvin Rose. He was at that time a CSIRO research scientist, and of course Professor Rose is still in the School of Environmental Studies and has been a very strong and good influence. And with him came Professor Brownlee, and I think Professor Brownlee is still with you, Arthur Brownlee, who established some new things in university studies altogether in Griffith. And I wish I could, well, I have now recalled the 4 school chairman and therefore deputy chairman.
Yes.
So we did establish, I think, very strong leadership in the four schools. I must record that Fitzgerald, when he withdrew his candidature as chairman of the School of Modern Asian Studies, said that when he became ambassador in Beijing, he would invite Griffith to send a delegation to Beijing, and he would see that we were received by universities in China. Well, Professor Fitzgerald kept his word, because in mid-1973, Professor Willett and I were attending a conference of Commonwealth universities in, must have been in Edinburgh, it was in Edinburgh. Yes, this was an interesting conference, and I'll come back to it. In mid-1973, Fitzgerald sent word to say that Griffith, he had already taken up his post in Beijing, that Griffith would be welcome to come to China in either November or December of that year. Well, Willett sent back word that we would go to China, and we did. But before I come to the China visit, I'd like to record that at this conference in Edinburgh, Professor Willett and I interviewed Dr. Ross.
Oh, yes.
Bob Ross, who is now a professor in Griffith University, and offered him the appointment as director of CALT, the Center for the Advancement of Learning and Teaching in Griffith University. Now, that institution, of course, is quite remarkable in university affairs, because the planning committee had decided we should be very greatly concerned not only with teaching but with learning. And we're also concerned that teaching should be at the highest possible standard, and that university teachers, if I may use that expression.
They call themselves teachers, not lecturers, most of them.
Oh, do they? Yeah. I'm pleased to hear that, yeah. Miss Toms, because I wondered whether they still remember that that was the fundamental function, was, yeah, teaching. But we were concerned that we should have an institution like CALT which could assist the early staff in planning courses and assist the early staff in offering the highest level of teaching and the best possible methods of learning, and with all the possible aids to learning that are now available scientifically. And it was in Edinburgh in 73 that we found Dr. Ross, who was then a pro vice chancellor of the Open University in the United Kingdom, a distinguished academic in his own right in those days, and we were very proud to persuade him, pleased to persuade him to come to Griffith. And I'm pleased he's still with Griffith and has still got an essential post in pursuing the excellence in teaching and learning. But now back to Fitzgerald keeping his promise. When Willett and I returned from Edinburgh, one other thing in Edinburgh I must record, because it should go into Griffith history, because nobody in Griffith believes it, that we had made, Willett and I, we made quite a mark, although we were still 2 years before we were open for teaching, but we were permitted to go to attend this conference of British universities, and it was attended by very distinguished people like Professor Cowan, the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Queensland, and distinguished academics and administrators from the English-speaking world. There was a great argument about student representation on the governing bodies of universities, and I astounded the gentleman by saying that Griffith, in its planning committee, had two students on the committee planning the university. This was received with expressions of open horror by some of the English gentlemen. And then I said we were putting three students on the governing body when the university was open for teaching and research and learning. And this was regarded with such astonishment by the academic press that the higher education supplement of the Times, London, sent a representative to interview me and to explain this radical idea. And I was interviewed and explained why we thought we should have students on the governing body. And I was reported with this description, Mr. T.C. Bray, that radical Antipodean. That radical Antipodean, a description which my family regards with complete contempt and derision and has amused all my academic friends. But it was a radical idea in the eyes of many university administrators so recently as 1973, so that I'm on record as a radical, that Antipodean, or that radical from the Antipodes. But back to Fitzgerald and his promise. When we return to Australia, Willett set about organising the visit to China, and we set out. And we did, in November, December of 1973, have a nearly three-week visit to China, at which we established very important contacts with universities in Canton, Guangzhou now, in Beijing, then Peking, and in Shanghai. And I've been back to Guangzhou since for the 50th anniversary of the set-up of Sun Yat-sen, where we've had constant contact with exchange of students and staff from that beginnings in 1973. And Fitzgerald looked after us in Beijing, and the people who went on the visit were Professor Willett and his wife, Professor Ho, myself and my wife, and this party of five was we received with great... they made a real fuss of us in China, because we were the first university visit from Australia from the time that Chairman Mao opened up the country again to academic visitors. And while we were in China, Kissinger was running around. We saw him running around Beijing trying to organise a visit by the President of the USA to China. And we were wonderfully well received. It was quite remarkable that Willett found colleagues in the universities down in, well, then Canton, our first visit to the Sun Yat-sen University. We had a very difficult time because the interpreter with whom we had provided, although Ho could have done it, but they wouldn't let him, was not acquainted with academic terms. And Willett was trying to explain to the staff of Sun Yat-sen how we were going to have integrated teaching and integrated research, and that concept was beyond them, quite beyond them. And all other things we had in mind could not be explained through the interpreter. So after about an hour of struggling, the vice-chancellor of Sun Yat-sen said, look, it's best we take a walk. So we went out into the air, and then I said to the vice-chancellor, who obviously himself had a good command of English, I said, why are we working so laboriously when you understand? He said, but my colleagues don't, and I can't leave them out. Because that was a time, literally, when students were running universities in China.
I was just going to say that was still the period of the
Cultural Revolution. Oh, it was still the period, in the revolution.
Yeah.
And he dare not do anything without the his colleagues knowing exactly what was going on. But I said, look, well, this can't go on. But I said, and obviously, sir, you have been abroad. Where were you? He said, Harvard. And I said, what did you do? He said, MBA. I said, well, for God's sake, Willett's an MBA of Harvard. Why don't you go and talk to him? And they did, and there was no more problem. But he had still to work at on formal occasions.
Yeah.
But that was broken down in Peking, where we went to one university in Peking, and the vice-chancellor came or greeted us for lunch. We'd spend a morning in what they called the Department of Economics, well, I couldn't understand what they were doing, and they couldn't understand what we were doing. It was a complete mess. Ho Ping Ok was struggling, and of course Ho Ping Ok was an absolute genius. Everywhere we went in China, although he'd not been to China before, he knew exactly where we were, all the legends, all the stories, all the history, and all the language and the dialects, every city we went. But this visit to lunch, the Vice-Chancellor received us, and obviously he had been abroad too, and he was obviously a man of great standing, because he had a beautiful suit and a magnificent pair of leather shoes. And you, everywhere you go in the world, Miss Toms, look at the shoes, and that'll tell you whether they're in the higher echelon or not. Mm. If you've got good shoes, you're on the top of the tree. He had a beautiful suit and he had beautiful shoes. And we went into lunch. I said, "Sir, how are we going to work? We've had trouble with language." He said, "We'll work in English." I said, "What about your colleagues?" He said, "They can wait for the translation." That was the only time he did it. And then I said, "What can we talk about?" He said, "Anything. Politics?" He said, "Yes." And I said, "Well, first of all, can I ask, what's your background? You've obviously been out of the country. Where did you go for your studies abroad?" He said, "Chicago and Caltech." And there's nothing better for a scientific top off to go to Chicago and Caltech. Mm. And we had a wonderful luncheon with that Vice Chancellor. So Fitzgerald paid off in the end, and he's made it easy for he made it while he was ambassador easy, and of course it's always been easy, because twice removed later, Hugh Dunn was an ambassador in Beijing. But I'm diverting, patience, get back.
Well, one of the things, of course, that has been peculiar to modern Asian studies is that right from the beginning we've had an exchange program with students between Griffith and universities in China, and the language institutes in China. And I imagine that your early visits and Professor Fitzgerald's goodwill has been very helpful in that.
Yes, it worked out well. There have been some problems, because the students who come down from China obviously come down hoping they get qualifications which will enable them either to work here or in some country outside China, which leads to a great deal of ill feeling. Because when I went back for the Sun Yat-sen's 50th anniversary back in into the 80s to represent Griffith, I was the only Australian invited to these celebrations. We then had a young student in residence in the Sun Yat-sen University, but we had two students down here from Sun Yat-sen, and I was not allowed to leave Canton to come home after the celebrations until I gave whatever assurance I could that the Chinese students from Canton who were studying here for their PhDs would return to Canton. They literally kept me in my room until I swore by all my gods that these gentlemen would be sent back to Canton, because
it's very understandable.
They'd lost so many going to America who just didn't go home.
Yes.
Didn't go home. But I think our arrangements have worked well, and we made some good arrangements in Shanghai, and I think they've been preserved, and in Beijing they've been preserved. I think we've got the stronger Griffith. I shouldn't say we, but Griffith has got the strongest and most enduring and longest-lasting relations with Chinese universities, of any Australian university.
Well, you should say we, because you're part of Griffith and always will be.
Well, I was then, and
but you're an honorary, the only honorary doctor of Griffith.
No, I'm the only DGU, if you want to get it on the
doctor
record.
Of Griffith University.
Because there were two of us. There was Hannah, the governor of Queensland, who was made the first one, but Hannah died. I was the second DGU, and then the rules were changed to DU.
DU.
So I am now the only surviving DGU.
Did you ever go to represent Griffith in Japan?
No. Ho Ping Ok did that marvellously well, and so did Professor Willard and a number of others, I've no doubt. But I wouldn't have put on record, because Ho Ping Ok is a great favourite of mine. Ho Ping Yeo went to Japan and lectured in Japanese and was reported in the popular press. Well, the popular press there has the largest circulations in the world, up to 6 million a day, as the Japanese professor from Australia lecturing in Tokyo. A remarkable man, and I regret that the pursuit of teaching languages was not as strong as it continued as strong as it was originally in the School of Modern Asian Studies, because we originally had the idea that nobody could get a degree in Asian studies unless they had a certain competence in one of the three languages we were teaching. And I hope, I sincerely hope, Griffith will get back to that standard. I know it. You yourself, Miss Toms, acquired enough Japanese, Chinese to qualify as that degree of competence in the language to get your degree in Asian studies. But the gentlemen or ladies and gentlemen controlling the school relaxed the rules, to my regret. I hope someday that rule will be reimposed.
I think you will find that there will be a much greater competency about with the students in Asian languages now, because at that stage, I think even Japanese was only being taught very minimally in Queensland schools, but Chinese was not, except in perhaps one or two private schools, and Indonesian, I think, was not. But now the concentration on languages, foreign Asian languages particularly, is coming back into the schools. Chinese is developing a lot, and that means that you'll get people coming into the university who have got already some competency in the language.
Well, if you retain your powerful position as Deputy Chancellor, Ms. Toms, I hope you will use your authority to persuade your colleagues to re-establish that requirement for a degree, a competence in one of those three languages, because as you pointed out, there is a stream of young people coming through the primary and secondary schools in Chinese, Japanese and basic Malay. Particularly Chinese is now very strong in Australian schools. In Queensland, we are specialising in teaching Chinese in primary and secondary school. We're getting teachers from China and or apart from the Australian teachers trained to teach in Chinese. So it should be possible for the university to re-establish that rule.
There are still some people who, for, I think, lack of a musical ear, are unable to cope with a foreign language. And if they are gifted and hardworking and succeed in the other areas of their Asian studies, I think it would be unfair to forbid them a degree. I think it has to be helped along, but not made a final definite decision that you must have one of the competency in one of the languages.
Well, you did have it once, Miss Toms, and you can't have it again.
Yes, well, it would be good if it were possible.
We'll disagree, but you're more tolerant than I am.
Well, one of the things, of course, you said that your idea originally was to establish Asian studies for modern Asian studies for undergraduate teaching, and it was the first in Australia, the first university in Australia to do this. The interesting thing is that it was not popular throughout the other states in Australia, and the Asian Studies Association, which was formed and became established in other states as well as Queensland, had a conference at this university. I think it was in 1982, and the people who came up from the south to attend this conference were saying, oh, you know, you're doing very well in Asian languages up here, but we can't do anything with it down in Victoria, in South Australia, in New South Wales. Nobody's really interested in it. Well, this area has grown tremendously in Griffith, and I think Griffith has led the resurgence, well, not resurgence, the emergence of interest in Asian languages in other states. So that comes back to your work.
All over Australia we've stirred up interest in Asian studies, and I'm proud now to hear that you have in Griffith the largest body of students in Asian studies in any university in Australia, 1,000 students.
Wonderful, isn't it?
It is. It shows that what we started then has become a success. Could I go back right to the beginning?
Yes.
Because I have overlooked the fact that in the early planning year or two, say in 71 and 72, the interim council, the planning committee, not only operated with, you know, those people appointed, but we co-opted people from the general community to the number of little committees which were subcommittees of the planning committee. We went out into the community and we got the public of Queensland advising us, as well as those who had been appointed to the committee. We had, we must have had 100 people co-opted in the early stages from the community attached to, you know, to the legal end of the legal planning and to the financial planning. We've spread right out into the community. We had a wonderful community effort in setting up Griffith. And we kept in mind that we were a university which was not only serving a limited academic community of staff and students, but we were serving the public, because we did, I think, something which had not been done before. We, for instance, opened up the library when we set up the university. We said to these people on the south side of Brisbane, or anybody in Brisbane, you can come and use Griffith Library facilities. And we did try and set up some sort of a cultural centre. We set up our Works of Art Centre, which brought some cultural from the Works of Art, concentrating on, you know, art and paper, because it was cheaper and it can be stored more easily. And we set up music on this side, which they're not. There was no cultural centre of any kind south of the river outside the just immediate south Brisbane, where there was once a little theatre. There was nothing else on the south, over on the south side until we came.
It was the South Brisbane Cultural Centre or something, was it? A tiny little organisation, which still exists today. But,
yes.
You know,
we did get the public interested in the university. Mm. I remember we went all around the schools in the early days and told them what we were doing and told the public that to come and see what we were doing.
Yes.
And we tried to say, well, now the university is a public institution, it's for the public.
Yes.
It's not just for the favoured few.
No. Yes, that's always been the idea at Griffith, that a cooperation between the public and the university, and for the good of the university and for the good of the people at large.
Yes, I think perhaps I could, you know, this session just wind up by saying, you know, that I want to pay a tribute to those people who assisted me. Some of them have gone: Butts, Petfield, Mason. But those who are still around, it must be known that they were tremendous enthusiasts for setting up a totally new and different university. Always in our mind was that we were not going to be a copy or an annex of any other university. We were going to be a different and innovative university. And that idea was pushed ahead with tremendous vigour when Willett came, because if ever there was an innovative vice-chancellor, it was John Willett. Mm-hmm. And we did try to do things differently. We did set up a different system of schools than, say, either Flinders or La Trobe or Macquarie, and I think our schools worked well. I hear you going back to faculties. I won't give you my opinion of...
Not departments.
No, but we did set up a new, an innovative system or idea of university teaching and learning. We had some wonderful people in the early stages. I don't think you could get more enthusiasm or more drive in leadership than John Willett gave us. and the fantastic support I got from every member of that planning committee, Mrs. Butzals and Len Butts, Alan Sewell, who succeeded me as Chancellor and is now gone. They were wonderful people. And that initial staff, and I must not forget the administrative staff, the Topley, the work he put in when he was seconded to me as a man who had been a personal assistant to Zelman Cowan. He came over to us and did tremendous work in the in the early planning and organising the everything for us. And then when we got people like Kev C in as the manager, the administration and the people who were surrounding Willett and Topley and C, they're dedicated people. Some of them are still with you. I would think it's the best university team has ever been assembled in the history of this country. Shall we leave today at that?
That would be good. Yeah. Thank you very much, Stephen.
How long have we been out of patience? A couple of hours.